everybody. This is Sholin Turner. You're listening to John on Iron City Rocks.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen and maniacs. This is John Gallagher from Raven, and you are listening to Iron City Rocks.
All right, Pittsburgh! You are the best! You got the best!
Welcome to episode 547 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host, John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing you the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 547 marks the beginning of our 16th year here in Iron City Rocks. January, usually very, very slow for bands traveling in and out of Pittsburgh, and also with NAMM, there's just not a lot of availability, so it's great to get back into full swing here in February. We have a lot of great guests on this podcast and many more coming up in the horizon. So thank you for joining us. If you're new to the show, tons to go back and listen to, and want to thank those who've been with us for a long time. Episode 547, we've got three super cool guests. We have joining us for the second time from Black Label Society and his new band, Dark Chapel. We have Dario Larina, who we're going to talk to in just a moment. And then a little bit later, we have from the band Raven, we have bassist and John Gallagher, vocalist. They have a new EP out called Can't Take Away the Fire, which has five new songs and three classic songs recorded live. So awesome to get new stuff from Raven, who have been around forever. And embarrassed to say, we've never spoken to them. So it was great to get a chance to talk to John. And then we have joining us a little while later, we have comedian TJ Miller, who many of you know from different shows and Netflix specials. He's a comedian who will be at the Improv later this week. So we'll get to him in just a little bit. First, we're going to start out with Dark Chapel. Dark Chapel have a new song out called Glass Heart, and they've got a new full-length album, the debut album, out the end of the month, which is called Spirit in the Glass. This is for fans of that love Black Label Society or remember his work with former Warrant singer Janie Lane. You know, Dario is an amazing guitar player. If you've had a chance to catch them live, he and Zach have always kind of gone on these cool guitar duels, so he's no slouch. And for fans of Black Label music, this is not a rap giant departure, so I think you'd enjoy checking that out. So we're going to play you a little taste of the lead-off single, and then we're going to get right into that interview. So here's just a little bit of Glass Heart that whets your appetite. Iron City Rocks, after far too long, we have Dario Larina on the line from Black Label Society. How you doing, Dario?
Great, man. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure, and excited to get a chance to talk to you today about a new band, Dark Chapel, which you guys are set to release your debut record in February. Had a chance to listen to it a couple times now. Thunderous. The great kind of stuff that all of us guitar players love to listen to. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you ended up kind of going on this creative outlet with this group of guys? Obviously, Brody, for example, has played with Sebastian Bach, and Mike is no stranger, Lewis, et cetera. How did you kind of come to form this union of guys?
Yeah, so I've had the vision for Dark Chapel for several years. And I was just writing, and I actually recorded the album, half the album, a few years ago, mm-hmm. In between, like, Black Label touring, and then, all the guys that did that with, you know, guys I knew here in Vegas, friends of mine. And then 2024, I finished the rest of the writing and we went in to record the rest of the album. And I found Mike and Lewis. So the band has kind of been in the creation process for a few years, but it all came together this past year.
From a writing standpoint, what time frame are we looking at here then? When did you kind of start, you know, putting riffs, or are you the kind of guy who just has this sort of phone full of riffs that don't have a home yet, and you kind of assemble when you get down to the business of writing, or can you kind of walk us through the time range on this?
I don't know the exact year. It was several years ago. So we could say 2021, maybe 21 area. I always have songs rolling. I'm always demoing. I put stuff in my phone, or when I'm home, I like to just sit down and start demoing something out with Pro Tools, usually starting with a riff and then building off of something from there. Normally, like when I sit down, I'm jamming, I'm coming up with a riff. When I come up with the riff that I'm feeling, that's usually what I lay down and start building off of. So not necessarily like going back into a stockpile going, oh, I like that riff, let me work on it. It's just kind of like what's coming at you right there. I like to demo everything out. So I'll demo everything here, and then get it all pretty much like rough drafted out. And then we start jamming it as a band and seeing what might get added or changed just from playing it. And then we go from there. When it's all, you know, rough drafted out, then we'll go and record the final version.
How much does a song change in that? You know, you talk about, you know, playing it with a band, because I mean, I think every guitar player sits down and they noodle riffs out, or, you know, have little ideas in their head, you know, maybe with a drum machine, maybe to play around with it in Pro Tools. But when you're actually a collective group of humans, you know, with people with other ideas, or, you know, maybe your bass player plays a little something that you didn't expect and it kind of takes you in a different direction. Does it change a lot, or do you kind of, where it started is close to where it ends?
It's pretty close from where it started to where it ends, but I mean, definitely things can take a different shape, whether it's like, oh, let's change the way the intro comes in, or let's extend this one section because it feels better when we're playing it, or then when the guys start laying the stuff on, drums might take a bit of a different approach, like, oh, that beat sounds killer when you're in the studio and actually hearing things back as they're gluing together. It stays pretty much, you know, pretty close to where it started, but it definitely evolves as people start putting their feel in it.
How do you think you've been in Black Label for 10 years now, which boggles my mind. It seems like 10 months, maybe not to you, but to me. How much do you think that had an influence just kind of watching the way Zach and you know, people that, you know, he surrounds himself work? Does that influence you in how you kind of approach this versus maybe what you did, you know, back in some of your early Shrapnel releases, which was, you know, kind of a different animal? Do you feel like you learned a lot from that experience?
Oh, definitely. I mean, just unknowingly absorbing from, you know, being around all that for, I think it's been 11 years and definitely feels like yesterday. And musically, just everybody in Black Label so phenomenal and inspiring. So, yeah, you just unknowingly absorb all that from being around it.
Does it help to watch in a way the way Zach and you know, his team, his wife, have kind of built Black Label into, dare I say, a brand as well? I mean, it's certainly it's music, but it's there's more to it than that. I mean, there's a pretty overwhelming sense of community when you become a fan of Black Label. It isn't like, you know, you're a casual fan. People, you know, don on the colors and, you know, does that kind of factor into how you approach Dark Chapel? you know, not necessarily mimicking it, but, you know, kind of seeing from a business standpoint. I mean, you're around, you know, Zach and I'm sure indirectly Blasco and some really guys who are really good at the business of music. Does that kind of rub off as well?
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, unknowingly, just as like we were just talking, just from absorbing it. But I mean, right now I'm just, it's the beginning of Dak Chapel, so just getting it rolling and like to see where it's going to go.
Yeah. Now, as far as getting to tour with this, I mean, you guys are all kind of coming from different worlds. You mentioned, you know, all of the guys in the band have other things going on. But, you know, as any more than when, you know, I look at like what life was like for JD as a musician when Zach was still playing with Ozzy and doing Black Label, there's inherent downtime in your schedule. Does that help in, you know, the idea of taking Dark Chapel on the road? And do you have plans for that at this juncture, or is that still kind of taking shape?
Yeah, no, definitely have plans for it. We're definitely planning to get out there, working on all that now as the album's about to come out. But yeah, we definitely plan to be on the road. And Black Label has the downtime for the rest of this year, but I mean, we have a couple things coming up throughout the year. But we'll be on the road. Dak Chapel will definitely be out there.
Would as far as performing this live, I mean, it was the thinking that you'd be able to go out on the road with the same group of guys, or is it you've got to kind of inherently have a little bit of wiggle room just because of logistics? You know, if Sebastian's on the road and you know, you lose a guitar player to that tour, it's sometimes hard for guys to say no to the, you know, the day job. Do you kind of account for that?
I mean, right now I plan on using all the same guys. Brody's actually, he's doing his thing. So I have another guitar player, Dylan Dice. With Dylan, Mike, and Lewis, that's the lineup I plan on.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. It's a fantastic record. Hopefully when those tour dates make, you'll see the light of day. We'll see, you know, Western PA or Ohio, you know, somewhere drivable so we can get a chance to check this out. Because I think a lot of people, I know from when you guys were in town with Anthrax, you know, people who may not have seen this incarnation of Black Label saw what you did and boy, did that make a statement! You know, certainly weren't in the shadows in that particular show that night. It was amazing to watch the two of you kind of go at it with the shredding. So it made a hell of an impression. So we look forward to seeing you and letting you spread your wings in this kind of setting. So Dario, I want to thank you so much. Wish you all the best with the new record. It will be out February 28th. I appreciate your time, man.
Yeah, man. Thank you. And looking forward to be back in PA with Black Label, with Dark Chapel. And thank you again.
All right, Dario. Thank you so much. Great stuff. And we'll see you, I'm hoping, darn soon, man.
Definitely.
All right. A big thank you to Dario Lorena, Black Label Society. Obviously, be out on the road this year. Hopefully, Dark Chapel will be as well. The new album is called Spirit in the Glass. It is out the 28th of February. The lead single, Glass Heart, is available now. I invite you to check out the whole album. Had a chance to listen to it. It's really worth your time. We're going to turn our attention now to a band, as I said at the top of the show. Kind of embarrassed we've never had them on before. With their new EP, Can't Take Away the Fire, we have joining us John Gallagher from Raven. Raven, a band I remember very distinctly going into the record store and seeing, you know, kind of the antics, for lack of a better term, on the album covers and stuff. But one of those bands that I think influenced so many of the bands that went on to become massive, you know, bands like Metallica and the thrash movement. So really enjoyed getting a chance to sit down with John and talk about this new EP. So without further ado, John Gallagher of Raven.
Ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome Iron City Rocks from the band Raven. We have John Gallagher on the line. How are you doing this morning, John?
I'm doing great, man. Good to be here.
It's an absolute honor to get the chance to talk to you. You guys are going to be dropping a new album. It seems like all hell's breaking loose just came out yesterday, but here we are with another album from you guys, which is awesome to see. This one has five, correct me if I'm wrong, yeah, five new songs, as well as a couple kind of classics done live. Can you talk about the decision to do, you know, just five new songs, you know, as opposed to just maybe doing an EP, but you threw in some live stuff? Is there advantageous to do it this way? Or is it just that's what you guys had? Well, you wanted to be concise?
Yes, in our mind, it's a bonus for the fans. It's an EP, so it's not a full album. But we knew we were heading into some things that were going to slow us down a little bit. I mean, Mike moved, our drummer Mike Heller, who, you know, we did the partial of Metal City in his studio, and we did the whole of All Hell's Breaking Loose in his studio. So do we want to kind of repeat that? But he's moved, so he's building a new studio. So we kind of have to wait on that. So we knew that was going to be a factor. And the other factor is we just have way too many songs, and we don't want them getting lost in the shuffle. This whole, you know, let's put an album out every 3 years type of mentality, which has permeated the business, drives me nuts. It's like, you know, and then when a band finally puts an album out after 3, 4, or 5 years, and you're like, this is the best you could do. We're not like that. We've got very high standards. We're very prolific, and we got a lot of songs, so we want to share them. And, you know, we know from talking to our fans, they'll eat up whatever new material we're going to put out. They want to hear it. So, boom, here we go. Happy New Year.
Yeah, I mean, it's you bring up a great point, because, I mean, somewhere probably around the early 90s, this kind of shift happened from, you know, a band touring 8 months of the year and then holding up in a studio for 2 months and kicking out 8, 9 quality songs and going right back out on the road sort of changed. You know, it became a, like you said, 3 years, 4 years, you know, then you get a 90 minute CD or, you know, 78 minutes or whatever the limitations of a single CD were. But you're right. There was a lot of like, almost felt like filler. You know, there would be the 7, 8, 9 good songs, but then there'd be 6 or 7 more that we were like, okay, do we need all that?
Yeah, it's just, you know, extraneous nonsense. And just because a CD can hold pretty much what a double album on vinyl holds doesn't mean you have to just fill it up with whatever you've got.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's, you know, if you're going to do that many songs, you need a real unified concept, I think, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you can do Quadrophenia. You can do, you know, Tales from Topographic Oceans or Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. And, you know, the more progressive stuff certainly leans itself towards that. But if you're, you know, basically wanting to get people off their seats and jump around and headbang, you know, a 2-hour CD is a bit much.
Yeah.
You know, it's you're going to have great difficulty holding anyone's attention if it's just, you know, full on crush your skull. And we know that.
Yeah.
So when we're doing an album, like the last couple of albums, our mandate was purely 10 songs, no more, 35, 40 minutes, you know, get in, kill. And then when people have heard it, they're like, I want to hear it again. So that harkens back to Van Halen 1, the first Montrose album, you know, like Budgie, something like that, where it, you know, you hear it, you love it, and you want to hear it again. And it's not a chore or a task to sit through and listen to, what was it, the Red Hot Chili Peppers with Stadium Arcadium with like 400 songs. It's like, you know, you gotta, you're certain for the wheat in amongst the chaff. We don't want that. We want it all diamond, 100% all the way through. Yeah. And that's not to say that, you know, at some point we'll stretch out a little bit, but there'll be thought behind it. It's not mindless, oh shoot, we have to, we have to fill the gaps on this CD. Can you play a 9-minute guitar solo for me, Mark? Okay, let's do it.
Yeah. Not that we, some of us would eat that up, but you're right. I mean, I think Rain and Blood is maybe one of the great examples of just hit me with your best punch, leave me wanting more.
Yeah, I don't think anyone ever complained that that album was too short because, love it or hate it, it's a statement. And yeah. It was pretty groundbreaking in many ways.
Yeah.
And that's to be admired, absolutely.
Yeah, and there are albums out there, I will freely admit, that from artists I really love, that got so long and so bloated that, you go through it. And I'm not going to mention the name of the band, but there's a band out there, I haven't finished their one double album yet, and it's been out for a decade because it was like, this is 14 songs on just the first disc of songs that all kind of sound the same. I don't need another 8 more on the bonus disc of stuff,
that's it. And if you're going to do like a really long album like that, you're going to have variety, and you're going to have something to draw people into to warrant that.
You're right about
that's you. A great palette, you're not gonna, it's like an anthology of short short stories.
Yeah.
They're short stories. You're not going to do an anthology of like 10 volume freaking books. It'd be like, oh God, you never get through it. So, you got to, you got to pick your palette and then work with it. And, that's what we've certainly done. And along those lines, this EP, with it being shorter, is even more intense.
Yeah.
That was the impression that's, there is a little variety in that. There's a doomier, slow, almost like a heavy blues track, The Wreckage, which is something that we've never done, just to have a left turn and make people go, what? But it's great.
Yeah.
It's very cool and atmospheric. And at the same token, you've got like an anthem, like the first track we've put out, Can't Take Away the Fire. And then you've got a song which is blistering, it'll tear your face off, which is Black and Blue. So we mix it up.
Were these all songs particularly written for this particular project? Or do you, like you mentioned, you have a lot of songs. Do you kind of go back and say, okay, I've got this riff here that's been sitting around since 97. I haven't done anything with. I've got a lyrical idea. This seems to work rhythmically. How do you kind of piece them together? Or do you just start with a blank slate? 2024, we're going to write an album.
Yeah, that happens. I mean, that happens because, we write so much. You will, it's not so much, dredging through old tapes and computer files to go, let me go hunting for riffs. Sometimes an old one will just pop up in your head and you'll go, why didn't we ever use that, Or it's a song that's got a, like a substandard chorus, or it doesn't have a good bridge. And when you're writing stuff, you go, hey, this would fit great in that one we never finished. So that'll happen. But these songs, a couple of them are like that, and a couple of them were written for the EP. So a bit of a mixture with that. But that's certainly happened. We've had, I think it was starting back with maybe Extermination. I just got on this whole trip of like, I'm going to, hunt down some of these really cool ideas that were never finished and, tie them off, put a bow on them and go, what do you think, guys? And it's, a good song doesn't have an expiration date.
That is, that's
just
the
what
truth.
You do with it. So,
John, when you write.
And we had for like the last album, we had like a cache of maybe 30, 35 songs to pick from.
Okay.
And then it was a case of, okay, what's going to make a great album out of this lot? What would be a great opener? What would be a great end song? And we kind of pre-sequenced it and then went with that.
Do you end up in a situation where when you have that many songs where you're like, I love song fill in the blank, whatever it's called, but this doesn't fit with the other 9, let's put this on the shelf for 2 years.
That'll,
just thematically or rhythmatically.
Yeah, that absolutely can happen. And sometimes it's just a case of it'll spur stuff up when you're recording. You'll be like, you know, the creative juices are on. You start writing on the side, and it's just like, nah, we're good. We're good for now. Let's just hold that back, put it on the shelf. We'll come back to it later. You know, I was going through some old tapes for, like a legacy box set thing.
Mm-hmm.
I got approached to do something for Wiped Out and for All For One. If we've got the material, we definitely have the material for All For One. So that's an interesting thing for the future. But listening back, it's like, you know, rehearsal tapes back in Newcastle, and I'm hearing, oh, wow, this never went anywhere. And it's just this one riff, and then it, you know, it turns up on, like, Life's a Bitch or something, like 4 years later.
Yeah.
Pretty funny. It does happen.
When you write, do you write with your brother, or do you guys kind of just, you know, bounce ideas once you've got, you know, here's a riff, or here's a lyric, or here's a bass line, or... You know, do you kind of write independent and then collaborate, or how do you approach, you know?
We try to do it all the ways, just because we're not too far away from each other now. Mark's only like 11 mile up the road, so we do see each other quite often. We'll do that. We'll, you know, throw ideas, bounce them off each other. We'll do stuff individually and maybe bring it into a verse chorus type of thing, and go, you know, where do we go from here? Mike came up with a whole bunch of riffs and ideas for the last album. I mean, Turn of the Screw was his riffs, which, you know, great. So, you know, and as far as the arrangement, everyone's hands-on on that and very critical and very, could we do better than this? I don't like that part. I have this other part that we did better, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we got, boxes with like 5 jigsaws with all the pieces lying on the floor. And we're like, you know, what would fit better here? That one or this?
Sure.
That type of deal.
Do you?
But to do that, always the song ends up somewhere a little different from whoever came up with the idea originally, and always better.
So yeah.
We always, you know, bring it where anyone puts their 2 cents in, you know.
Yeah, and I think that that's probably, you know, one of the things when people think, okay, why don't, you know, when people do solo albums and versus a band, and I think you might have just totally encapsulated in one sentence, you know, you come in with an idea, but you make it a Raven song, you know, because of the input of everybody else.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Do you write on bass?
Very, very much so, and it's important because, you know, there's just the 3 of us.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's musical contribution as far as what you hear on the record is hugely important because we have to orchestrate what we do. It's not just, guitar riff and then 4 on the floor drums and boom, boom, right. Boom, 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 boom on the bass. It's an awful lot more involved than that. You know, I'll play counterpoint to what Mark's playing on the guitar to bring more out of it, to make that riff bigger.
Yeah.
Won't play the same, you know, or won't just, you know, like I said, pound along on the root notes. And there'll be, you know, we'll put time changes and there'll be different fills and riffs and stops and starts. And, you know, you're basically, you've got structure with your, you know, intro, verse, chorus, middle 8, solo, maybe chorus out, if you took that as a template, but then you throw left turns in here and there.
Hmm.
And that's what spices it all up, you know?
As a vocalist and a bass player, you know, you're kind of in, especially in a trio, kind of in some elusive company, you know, Getty, for example. You've got a, you know, the bass is much more pronounced in a trio. Does that present some challenges to you as a singer, or does it, are you to the point now with a bass where you can kind of not think about what you're playing while you're singing, or how intertwined are those two? Because that's not an easy skill, you know, especially for young musicians to sing and play guitar, play bass, play drums, whatever. But, you know, when you're the bassist in a trio, what you're playing matters quite a bit.
Yeah, I think it's a lot easier playing guitar and singing because you're usually just playing, you know, a repetitive part.
Mm-hmm.
Usually. And the bass can go against what the vocals are doing. And very rarely can I think that I've ever dumbed down the bass line because it was too difficult to... There's some tough ones. I mean, we had a song on Architect of Fear called Under the Skin, which had this off-time button, 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 and the vocal was in 4/4. That was quite a challenge. You know, so that was what would be an example? Something like Jacob's Ladder by Rush, if you imagine him, even though he cheats and just plays long bass notes, but if he was matching the guitar where it's got that 7/8 thing against 4/4, it's like whoa. but that's fun, that's a challenge, it's great. I love that stuff.
That's a special skill in itself, you know. Even take away some of the notes you hit while you're singing, you know, in the vocal range and you know the message, just the mathematics of what you're trying to do with 7/8 and 4/4 and is enough to trip up many men. So it's really cool to listen.
Yeah, it's usually not a problem. I'll figure out a cool bass line and then I figure out a cool melody. It's usually that way around.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, rarely you'll have a vocal melody if it was just like, you know, you come up with a melody over the guitar. And then you try to find an interesting bass line to go along with it. But there are absolutely people out there over the years. I mean, Greg Lake, John Wetton.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people are unbelievable at doing that, you know. So that's, we aspire to try and do that.
Yeah. I mean, the cool thing is, I mean, you've been at this now for more decades than probably either one of us want to count. And you guys are still pushing the envelope and, you know, have that desire and spark.
That's the bottom line. And that's what puts us in pretty rarefied company, I think. There's a bunch of bands, especially in our genre, for want of a better word, that are, you know, they're out on the road. They're doing great. But they're not really doing great as far as new music's concerned. They've either stopped doing new music, or the new music is people are making excuses to say, well, it's not as good as the classic stuff, but it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I want pretty good. I want total excellence and better than we've ever done. And we've really fought hard over the last 10 years and faced that and said, I'm fed up with people going, I love your new album, but man, those classic first three. I'd say, you know, that needs to be banished. We need to work harder. And it's difficult because you're working against the great example my brother comes up with is we met these kids and they're like, yeah, when we were like 15, we stole my dad's car and we drove to California from New Jersey and we had one tape, All for One.
Yeah.
So they're going to listen to that. And that's in your brain. That's part of your life. And to try and compete with that is very difficult. Because music has that effect of, oh, I remember, you know, the first girl I went out with, or, you know, my friends from high school. And that hardwires the music in your brain, which is very difficult to, like I say, to compete with. But it doesn't mean it's impossible. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't try. So that's been our thing. And to get the reviews we've had over, like, the last two albums, and even just the reaction the last couple of days doing interviews on this new EP, you know, it's paid off, you know.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. I think, you know, when we were listening to your early catalog, you know, it was a tactile product. You know, you put the cassette in the car, you put the record on the turntable, the CD, but you didn't have at your disposal the ability to skip tracks, go back, playlists. The things that, you know, you're honestly competing against yourself in some ways. You know, if I tell my smart device to play your music, it doesn't spit out, you know, brand new song right away. You know, it's going to go through your top five most played songs, then maybe it'll squeak one in, you know, if you're lucky. Where, you know, I remember doing this when the last Van Halen album came out, back when you had a CD in your car, and taking everything else out of my car except that one CD for a month, just to try to recapture that. And it's amazing you can still do that with new music. But I mean, you look at radio, I mean, not that unfortunately Raven gets a lot of terrestrial radio play, but you know, radio stations aren't going to play it no matter how good it is. They don't play the Rolling Stones new material.
No, you're going to get maybe a college station here or there where there's an actual DJ. Otherwise, it's all robotic, and they have a playlist of 20, 25 songs. It's like you put the radio on the car and it's some classic rock thing. It's like, really? We're going to hear Comfortably Numb again? Sharp Dressed Man?
But Back in Black.
Pour Some Sugar on Me. I mean, it's the same old, tired stuff. It's like, why don't you play those bands and play the other tracks?
Yeah.
For God's sake.
Yeah.
They actually have a classic rock station in the UK called Planet Rock, and they do that. I was listening to it for off and on for like a week or two, and they never repeated a song.
Yeah,
it was such a breath of fresh air. What a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up like Pour Some Sugar on Me. I mean, Def Leppard had a very catchy single on their last album. And darned if you can remember the name of it, because you haven't heard it since the week it came out. You know, that's just the way it is.
True.
You know, so, John, I want to thank you.
It's a shame, but I think in some ways that's driven a lot of the younger people to, when they hear this, they get bored instantly. Because, you know, that's maybe a positive thing of a short attention span. They're like, nah, I don't like this. And they start digging in their parents' CD or vinyl collection.
Yeah.
Or they start digging online. It's like, I like this guitar player, and he's talking about Budgie. What the hell's a Budgie? And they dig, and they go, ooh. So Metallica like Budgie. Who else did they like? And then they start digging into the new wave of British heavy metal, and they start digging into, you know, and it's a whole rabbit hole. And then you get these kids who are 18, 19, and they've like got great command of the entire history of music. It's like amazing.
Yeah, that is the complete upside to the you know, digital age of music, is that, you know, I can, you know, like you said, I could read a Wikipedia page on Lars, and it's, he was into King Diamond. I could pull up, you know, and listen to King Diamond in a couple seconds, you know, at my disposal.
Yeah.
It unfortunately doesn't pay you guys as well as you deserve for that influence. But
they do get that, you know, because of the, you know, the way our brains are wired, the metal fans, we want that experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the kids are learning that, and they want the vinyl if they can get it, even if it's just to have the art and then buy a CD to listen to it, or they'll rip the vinyl and listen to it then. Because they want to sit down and take time and read the liner notes and read, you know, and, you know, it's like we put a lot of thought and work into sequencing the album and putting that art together. And to have a throwaway, nameless digital file come out of that is just sad, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, it's like going into an art gallery and some guy spent 6 months painting the painting, and all you get is somebody going, yeah, look at this painting here, and well, take it away, just look at the frame. The frame's great, you know? You're not getting... You're missing, you know, 90% of what's going on just by hearing one, you know, selected track with no information whatsoever.
Amen. Amen to that. But John, I want to thank you so much. Hopefully we will see you guys out on the road before too long. I know you guys did a lot of dates in 2024, but if fate has you come in the Western PA area, we would love to see you.
Oh, absolutely, man. Absolutely. We should be touring. We should be touring. Because they're booking European dates for us in September. So either right before that or right after it.
Okay, so we'll look forward to getting to see you at least somewhere. Can't Take Away the Fire is available on Valentine's Day here in the U.S. On your website, Raven Lunatics, I know there's some links to get the limited edition signed copy.
Limited edition. They're all going to be signed. All signed. So go grab it while it's there.
Yeah, that's an awesome treasure there. So, John, I want to thank you so much. I wish you guys all the best, and we will, I imagine, be talking in about a year with another full-length album at the pace you guys go. So, all the best.
We'll see you later in the year. Thanks so much, man.
All right, the new EP, Can't Take Away the Fire, from Raven will be available on the 14th. That's 5 new tracks, 3 live recordings. Should be an awesome thing to have in your collection. You can get some autographed copies if you head out to their website, so I invite you to do that. Hopefully we'll see them on tour before too long. And speaking of on tour, this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, that's the 14th, 15th, 16th of February at the Improv in Homestead, comedian, actor TJ Miller will be there. He's been in things like Deadpool, Family Guy, The Emoji Movie, Office Christmas Party, just to name a very, very small few. He will be in town to do his stand-up routine. He's got a really cool, very, very funny listen if you have something like Spotify or something. It's called Smooth Peanut Butter that is worth your listen, and he's going to be coming in this weekend to do all new material. So we're going to talk to TJ Miller right now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome to Iron City Rocks. We have on the line the Razor Scooter guy, Mr. TJ Miller.
Yes, how are you doing today? Iron City Rocks.
How are you doing today, TJ?
Really good, man. I'm so excited to be coming back to Pittsburgh. It's one of my favorite cities in the United States. And I think it's also a city that people, if they haven't been there, they kind of underestimate it, because they just, I don't know, they think of it as Steelers Nation and that's sort of it. You know, kind of a working class town. But when you really know Pittsburgh, you know about Andy Warhol, Carnegie Mellon, you know, how beautiful it is, Mount Washington, the inclines, the bridges. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. And I just like the people there.
It's sort of
the opposite of Philadelphia.
No comments on Philadelphia, especially this morning. But it is interesting. You mentioned, you know, you talk about football, and I'm guilty of that too. Football is a big part of our diet here in Western Pennsylvania. But anytime you watch a football game from Pittsburgh, it's kind of like a drinking game. When are they going to say the word blue collar? Certainly is in the DNA. Certainly
I
DNA.
I've heard that before. Yeah.
Not everybody in the city goes around in a hard hat and a lunch pail. So I appreciate you recognizing the city. You've got 5 shows this weekend, 2 Friday, 2 Saturday, and a show on Sunday. And just excited to get a chance to see you guys, you coming in. Can you talk a little bit, you know, looking back, you've had quite an involved career with acting and voiceover work and comedy going back to
illustrious.
Yeah, it certainly is. Can you talk a little bit? I mean, your parents were both pretty accomplished professionally. Like, when you said, okay, I want to get into, was it acting or comedy that really kind of pulled you in first?
I think comedy. But, you know, the way that you do that when you're young is in plays.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of do the drama plays from school. And the first play that I did was Dracula. I mean, I did something. I played Sir Gaius Gizmore in Robin Hood when I was, you know, in like 6th grade or something. But the first time that I was really actually, you know, in a play, I was in Dracula and I played the attendant. And he sort of had one really funny line. And it was kind of the last thing that I say. And the first time I delivered it and got a huge laugh, I think I just sort of said, whoa. This is something that's possible. How do I kind of do this more? And so I was in every play in high school and was on an improviser and kind of the improv team. And then when I went to college, I sort of got onto the comedy group there in Washington, D.C., called Recess at the George Washington University. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of my focus at GW. I mean, I got a degree in psychology with a concentration in persuasion theory and social influence. But you know, that was just something that I enjoyed studying. I was very, very focused on comedy. I think about sophomore year, I said, you know, I just got to go for this. This is what I want to do. So I was really lucky with that, too, because my wife, who I met in college, didn't know what she wanted to do for a long time after even graduation.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are guilty of that. We go to college because you finish 12th grade, you got to do something. We go to college. You go to college and you're about halfway through and you're like, I don't really know what I want to do. Was the psychology actually, I think about that, and I've not taken a ton of psychology classes, but did that kind of help you in a way with stand up to get an idea of how people react or not so much?
John, that's a good point. Yeah, it does, because you think you're sort of needing to think about how people think. Mm-hmm. And what they think about, you know, their life and what's around them. And I find that I think a lot about sort of, my wife said last night, she goes, you really like to be a part of things that are culturally relevant moments. Cause I don't watch a lot of football, but I always bet on the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And I learn kind of everything about the teams and, you know, all that. And then I kind of like to live as a football fan on that one Sunday. And then I'll talk about things like, you know, I talk a lot about cities.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out cities and the psychology of cities. I was just in Miami for much longer than I want to be or wanted to be. And so I spent a lot of time kind of trying to figure out what is Miami, you know, especially compared to Jacksonville, Florida, or Port Charlotte or Naples, or, and, you know, Florida itself and what people from Florida. And so I always get excited when I figure that stuff out. Like Miami is kind of addictive because it's the cross section between cocaine and laziness, which those two things don't usually go together. But you know, in Florida, it's just, people are very lazy. It's just a place where you can wear shorts to dinner, which I think is, right. You know, so I think about that a lot. And we have a place in Los Angeles, and I lived in Los Angeles for 8 years. But I, you know, not everybody knows this, but I lived in Pittsburgh while I did She's Out of My League.
Okay.
And
so
I lived at the Omni William Penn downtown, and I really got to know the city. Because also, you know, there's different scenes. Mount Washington, we have one scene there. We have one scene, you know, downtown. And so I went to all Pittsburgh airport, but I kind of really learned a lot about Pittsburgh. And I think if I lived anywhere besides New York, that would be top of the list for me.
It would,
you
be.
Know, and my wife's an artist. And so, you know, she actually is an installation artist. So the Warhol Museum is incredible. But for her, the Mattress Factory,
yeah,
which not everybody's been to, but that is the most important installation art museum in the United States and maybe the world. You know, it's probably that and another one in France.
Well, the doors certainly open. Do you have, like, you mentioned different kind of personalities to different cities. Are there certain parts of your show that you know this one's not going to work? Like, I was listening to your last comedy album, Smooth Peanut Butter, and you obviously you're in the heart of Nashville, and there's certainly a different culture to Nashville. You know, you had some bits about Austin, for example, in that show that I imagine you wouldn't do in Austin. Maybe you would, but I mean, do you have kind of like a you know, just in a notebook somewhere on your phone on a notes, you know, don't do this bit in Albuquerque. Do you have to kind of keep...
No, because I'll do any bit anywhere. You know, a lot of cities, I make fun of them directly. And I used to, I had such a bad time in San Francisco years ago that I stopped performing there. And just recently I went back and, you know, reframed how I made fun of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of complimented them. I said, but you guys are a lot better about it now. And so then, because they're so pretentious, they go, well, of course we are.
Yeah.
You know, we don't care. You're exactly right. And so now they're a little bit more open to being teased. But most every place in the United States loves to hear about themselves.
Yeah.
That's and they think it's fun for someone to make fun of them. And I think Denver, where I'm from, is actually one of the few places that doesn't really love that. They kind of think, hey, we're a great place, we're all nice, we wouldn't say that stuff about you. But because I'm from Denver, I can make fun of them in a way that, you know, other people can't. Because there's not really any comedians, like nationally touring comedians, that are from Denver. It's sort of me and one other guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then there's a third guy, but he doesn't tour in the way, or the level that I tour. He feels more indie rock, dude. This guy, Ben Roy, and then Adam Keaton Holland is the other comedian that I was talking about. But it's really, really fun to go back to Denver, but I feel at home in a lot of cities. Pittsburgh's sort of topping that. I feel really Pittsburgh, and then Kansas City, I feel pretty at home there. And then Los Angeles, I've just spent so much time there that, you know, the clubs are really places that I have a pretty intimate relationship with, because I've performed hundreds and hundreds of times there. But the thing about Pittsburgh is, like, you guys like it when I make fun of you, because you sort of make fun of yourselves, you know?
All the time.
And then, and then Pittsburgh people think it's really funny when you're kind of ragging on somebody else, because they're kind of in on that. And then because it's me, they kind of think, oh man, I wish he was making fun of me. You know, that would be so fun. Like Don Rickles. It's like Don Rickles, if you leave the show and he didn't say something about you, and let's say you're in the front row, you feel like you lost out. Like, ah, dang it, I wish he had said that my wife was ugly, you know, or something like that. It's really very strange, but I think that's kind of the deal. But I actually think, and this is true, I think that Pittsburgh people have a really good sense of humor. You know, I really think that they're just funny, and the way that they talk about stuff is funny, and it's just great. And I love, you're right. I mean, it's the people can't stop calling Pittsburgh people blue collar, and now it's like a hub for tech, which is the least blue collar. It's digital collar.
Yeah.
If I coin that phrase, I want to get a trademark on that ASAP.
Yeah, good luck with that. Somebody's probably got that already. When you do a show like the Smooth Peanut Butter album, did you know, or do you record all your shows, or did you know that night going into that? Because I was listening to that, and you kind of went after, you didn't call his wife ugly, but you went after some people in the audience kind of early on. I could see that potentially backfiring, especially when you're going to, you know, to a recording. Does that ever cross your mind? Like, you know, I better, you know, make sure this one flies because it's going to tape?
No, not really. But also, you know, it's almost every single time it goes well, just because people know that I'm not kind of making fun of them in a mean-spirited way. Mm-hmm. But I'll say this, and that is that, in Jacksonville, Florida, a girl sort of got on stage and tried to slap me.
Mm.
So occasionally it does backfire, and the security was not present that particular day. So Jacksonville, Florida is one of the few places it can get pretty, pretty roughneck. Atlanta can kind of do that too. But most people who enjoy me, if you know me from Deadpool or Silicon Valley, one of the things that my characters do is just make fun of people.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of, you know, they know what the deal is there. But I'm not very timid when it comes to stand-up, because I just think people sort of take everything with a grain of salt, and it's fun for them because it's me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you kind of, I think, if you haven't been to a stand-up show and you don't know to expect some of that, you're probably seeing a very limited kind of entertainer. Because you do kind of, you know, when you walk in the door. I mean, I've seen Bill Cosby, for example. He is not poking fun at people, but that's not his thing, you know. But I think any amount of comedians, you kind of know going in. And people should be relatively loose and kind of just roll with it and have fun with it.
Yeah, you kind of roll with it. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. What can I ask, because you're not alone in doing stand-up, but then doing a large amount of different projects acting-wise. And that seems to be a very common theme among comedians. Is that you know, how does that kind of to flow? I mean, is it just kind of a natural progression to doing like voiceover work and things like that? Is it, you know, how to deliver lines in a humorous way that kind of appeals to casting directors?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, honestly, it's a lot of improvisation, mm-hmm. you know, and the bummer is now all auditions or reads are over video.
Yeah.
And so I get offers for movies a lot, but the days of kind of going in and auditioning in person are sort of over, sadly. So, but the improvisation is what, you know, it's what differentiates me from other people. Mm-hmm. And so, and you'll see that in my stand-up, you know, but I think that's a lot of what got me jobs is just people knowing that, you know, if you hire me, you're also kind of hiring an author.
Yeah.
As well, or a writer, yeah.
Do you get, I mean, for those not in this business, which includes me, do you get a lot of leeway or latitude in lines when it comes to, you know, like a motion picture or things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt. Especially because it's me, but yeah.
Yeah, that's actually really cool. For those who maybe are familiar with the Smooth Peanut Butter album, will your show be similar in a way, or is this all new material?
No, it'll all be new material and then improvisation.
Okay.
That's it. And I'm one of the few comedians that can improvise an entire stand-up comedy, you know, an hour show. I can just improvise the entire thing. And so a lot of times people come and they just are like, how was that almost completely improvised? And it's like, yeah, that's something that I can do. And so sometimes if the audience is right and, you know, if I'm in the right headspace, then the whole show will be improvised. So you're not going to see anything from Smooth Peanut Butter. You're not really going to see anything from my YouTube channel. That's why it's so worth it going to see me live.
Yeah, that's really kind of cool. When you're done with your show, do you have a lot of times you kind of like forget, oh, I didn't get to this bit, or, you know, I mean, imagine the time goes really fast when you're on stage.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So you kind of walk off with I wish I'd have got this or I got that.
Yeah, I think sometimes, and more often than not, it's, golly, I need to work on my material. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally people will go, you know, people will say, oh, you know, I wish you'd done more material. Mm-hmm. Although that's pretty rare. But occasionally you get into a position like that and then you think, all right, well, it's a good thing, you know, I can improvise because, you know, I didn't need to fall back on the material. But when I prepare for a stand-up comedy special, which I'm not really doing right now, mm-hmm. then, yeah, I'll do a little bit more material and try and tighten that up. But that's fun, too. You know, it's fun to see sort of what I'm working on because it's usually pretty different from any other comedian.
Do the cameras make it, you know, like you tend to improvise less, would you say? You know, when you're doing something, you know, okay, this one's going, you know, this is going to be a product, I guess is maybe the best way to think of it. Because with streaming and digital and YouTube anymore, it's kind of, you know, it's not just a VHS or DVD anymore. But, you know, when you're going in to do a bit that you know is going to have a recording to it, do you have to kind of be a little more cautious of, you know, I want to hit X, Y, and Z by the time, you know, I hit the 59-minute mark, which gives you a little less time to do that kind of stuff?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if I'm doing a special, then it's stand-up. It's material that I'm trying to share with people. Mm-hmm. So I got to hit all of it. I can't. Right. But if the improvisation is, does it strike me? Is it an opportunity? Did someone say something strange to me?
Yeah.
So then I'm sort of waiting for it to happen organically. But mm-hmm. the amount of improvisation that I do and can do, honestly, usually is, how do I say this? It kind of makes me lazy, mm-hmm. you know, because I'll sort of think, okay, well, you know, we're shooting this and hopefully we get some great stuff out of it. Yeah, you know, I think, and I would rather improvise also.
Yeah.
So that's the most fun thing for me, is kind of, you know, improvising.
I have to assume that you kind of enjoy, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you've done a particular piece previously, you kind of have an idea of how people are going to react. I assume city to city, show to show, some of these, you know, sections, you know, get a very similar reaction. But your improvisation, I assume, has really got to be much more rewarding to you to see it go over well.
Yeah, and that's a lot of how I write as well. So, yeah, so I'm kind of, I'll come up with an idea and then I'll bring it on stage and just work on it. So, you know, that's kind of a good situation as well, in terms of, you know, that's the nexus between, feeling like, oh, okay, I did material and I worked, I got work done, but it was fun for me because I was improvising and putting it together.
Absolutely.
And then it becomes about refining it and refining it and refining it.
One question I've often wondered, you know, we deal with many, many musicians and who typically hit a town in a night. You know, you come in, the bus pulls in maybe by 5 o'clock and you're out by 11:30. You're in a different situation, you know, doing shows at the Improv. I notice this a lot, you know, typically it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So you're here. I'm assuming you'd come in sometime Friday, but like you have some downtime. I mean, is that nice to be able to kind of explore? I mean, obviously you mentioned being here for quite a long period of time during the filming of a movie, but you know, as you go city to city to have time to see the museums or other things, is that kind of the fun part of the job?
Oh, for sure. And I call it collecting material. So a lot of times I'll just go and try and have experiences that I then can get on stage and talk about. So, you know, for instance, I'll go to the Warhol Museum and I will, I'll for sure go to the Mattress Factory, but I'll go, you know, I'll go and see stuff. I'll take the incline.
Yeah.
If I'm inclined to. And that's kind of, yeah, that's a big part of being able to be there for a little bit longer. And I've done many tours where I just hit one place, get on the bus, hit the next place that, you know, the night after.
Yeah.
And it's fun, but it's a grind.
Yeah. I imagine you walking out on stage trying to remember what in the hell city you're in.
Right.
It's got to be tough, you know, and, you know, to have a little downtime. It's unusual with touring. I mean, most, you know, especially musicians, if they're not on stage, they're in a different town every night, they're not making any money. Where yours, it's kind of a, you know, it's an intimate venue, so you fill it up. I mean, you're darn near sold out 2 of the 5 shows at the moment. But it gives you a chance to kind of breathe, decompress, maybe actually unpack your suitcase for a bit.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All right, TJ, I want to thank you so much again. You're doing two shows. Friday, 2 Saturday, 2 Sunday. As I mentioned, 2 of them are virtually sold out, and they're very limited tickets to the others. So if you want to catch TJ by the time you're done hearing my voice, you should be at the checkout on the Improv's website. And TJ, I wish you the safest travel into town and have a great time in our city, and we will see you in just a couple of days, man.
All right, thanks, man. See you at the Improv, everybody.
All right, that about wraps up this episode of Iron City Rocks. Again, TJ Miller will be in town the 14th, 15th, 16th at the Improv at Homestead doing his stand-up comedy, 2 shows Friday and Saturday, 1 show Sunday. 1 show on Friday, 1 show on Saturday. By the time you hear my voice, are likely sold out, so you're going to have to pick from what's left. So, totally worth the time to check that out. Invite you to get over to the Improv's website, pick up tickets. That is the only place to get tickets safely. And then I remind you that Raven's new EP, Can't Take Away the Fire, will be out on the 14th. And Dario's new album with his band Dark Chapel will be out on the 28th. So I want to thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed this very metal and comedy-centric episode this time around. We've got some amazing stuff cooked up for you, and invite you, if you are in the Pittsburgh, Western Pennsylvania area, to keep an eye on our Facebook page, as we'll be announcing the winners of the 2024 Iron City Rocks Western PA Music Awards, and including this year's Hall of Fame inductee, which is always very special. And I think this one this year is going to be extra special. So invite you to check that out. IronCityRocks.com. We are on all the social medias as Iron City Rocks. And as always, you can drop us an email, IronCityRocks@gmail.com. Let us know, do you love the metal? Do you love the alt-rock? Do you love the comedy? What kind of genres are you into? What are things you don't want to hear? Love to hear thoughts either way. Don't just want flowers and roses. We want the truth. So let us know what you like, what you don't like, bands we may have missed, bands we're tired of hearing about. Let us know. Until next time, we do want to thank you for listening.